Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam. Welcome to the History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham coming at you today, nearly live from Ottawa, Ontario. But we have a very big show for you today. I'm very excited about this one. We have a man who has been referred to as the most famous historian in Canada joining us from Toronto, Ontario, Ian Mosby. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, I don't know if I quite agree with the most famous historian in Canada, but thanks for having me.
my pleasure. Merle Massey. That's where I read that, and you know what? I'm going to go with her judgment. And I got to say, this has been probably the most difficult interview to schedule.
It's been tough. Having a 9-month-old baby and doing a million talks makes it tough.
But it's exciting. I mean, I looked at your website today and looked at the schedule of talks. Like, you not only have you been all over the place, you are continuing to be going all over the place.
Yeah, people are really responding to this story, and I'm really honored to be able to talk to people about it around the country. So
I'm going to assume that most of the people who are listening to this are familiar with the story, but for those of people who aren't, and there are some listeners who I love that people listen to the show who aren't involved in history on a daily basis, for those folks, just give a little background on this article that you wrote that has been generating so much media attention.
Yeah, it was an article that was published in the summer in the journal Histoire Sociale, Social History, and I basically uncovered a series of nutrition experiments that were conducted both in a number of First Nations in northern Manitoba and in 6 residential schools across the country between the years of 1942 and 1952. And I was surprised that there was such an enormous response to it. It was on the front cover of the Toronto Star, for instance, 3 days in a row, and articles still continue to be published about it. And so there's clearly, it struck a chord.
Yeah, well, it's one of those things that, you know, if you've only done sort of history in high school, or even if you've done a survey course in undergrad, it's the sort of thing that you don't maybe expect to find in Canadian history.
I think that's part of it, yeah. And I think one thing is perhaps it made reporters and just ordinary people begin to look closer at what the residential school system in particular really was. And the experiments themselves are shocking, but the fact that they're not the least shocking thing that happened in these residential schools is perhaps gave people pause, and maybe journalists saw this as a means to discuss, you know, the legacies of these pretty terrible institutions.
So we've talked about what we're going to talk about in this interview. We're not going to focus on the content of the experiments, but what we're doing, for those of you who are only listening to this through iTunes, if you go to activehistory.ca, we have audio of one of Ian's talks that he gave in the fall at Acadia, and we're going to post that with this episode of the podcast. So if you want to go and get more information on the content and the nature of these experiments, go to Active History and the audio of that talk will be there. Or if you have access to a university library and get through the social history paywall, the article is there, and it was run in the May 2013 issue. It's called Administering Colonial Science, Nutritional Research, and Human Biomedical Experimentation in Aboriginal Communities and Residential Schools, 1942 to 1952. So if you're interested in sort of the content of it, and I've read the article, and it's really, in addition to the discovery that's made, and it's also pretty well written, and I would say the dreaded word that we use in academia a lot is it's accessible.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
I'm interested in sort of the background of this and then the reaction to it, and I'm curious to know, how did you find this? How did you find the evidence of these experiments?
Well, I wish I could say that I found them because, you know, I'm such an exceptional researcher, but I really found them by accident, doing research on something completely different. I was doing research for my dissertation, which is on the history of food in Canada during the Second World War. And a big part of that project was history of nutrition policy, nutrition research, and the science of nutrition during the 1930s and 1940s. And through the course of that research, I started to come across mentions of studies being done in First Nations and residential school that sounded a bit different than what was going on elsewhere. And so whenever I went back to the archives over, you know, a couple of years that I was doing my dissertation, I kept trying to order more documents that I thought, you know, might shed some light on what these studies were. And by the end of my PhD, I managed to put together, you know, enough that I knew that these were experiments and that they happened over a decade. And so when I got a postdoc at Guelph, one of the first things I did was I decided I would, you know, finish this research, and I managed to cobble together enough documents that I could tell the story in the form that I told it.
But why has this not been found before? I mean, you say you stumbled upon it, and so therefore it's in the record somewhere, and, you know, there's been focus on residential schools before. I mean, what sort of language is being used in these documents that it doesn't jump out at you? And because you said you sort of, something seemed off as you're reading it. So how are they sort of framing it that it was missed or maybe overlooked by other people?
Well, I've thought a lot about this, actually, you know, because one of the first things I thought when I found these documents, I'm like, oh, I should find the article that discusses this.
Yeah.
And I kept looking and I didn't find anything. Now, part of it is, you know, up until very recently, food history was not considered serious history. And, you know, it's possible, you know, some of my experience suggests that it's still considered by many not to be serious history. But it just means that there haven't been very many people who have been taking food and nutrition as their central frame of analysis. So, you know, the fact that this was the topic that I was interested in, I knew a lot about the context of food and nutrition, allowed me to see that these experiments were something different than just, say, you know, surveys of the quality of diets in residential schools. Like, I could see that something else was going on. Another part of it is that I'm trained as a historian of science and historian of medicine. And so I had some sense as to what the difference was between, say, a dietary survey and a double-blind controlled experiment. And I knew that those, you know, that distinction is very important. And so, you know, I think I was able to, because of my training, recognize these experiments as experiments and not just studies. And in fact, other historians have looked in these same record groups and looked at these same documents, but I think that they weren't able to see that they were experiments because they didn't have the background in the history of science. They weren't looking for the kind of keywords that I was finding,
right,
which included discussion of controls. You know, when you talk about having a control group among school children, that for me, that was sort of an alarm went off.
Mm-hmm.
But I could see how for someone else, that word buried within a long report might not seem off.
So you're going through these documents and you're finding these words. And obviously, I mean, at least for me, I mean, sort of my mind would start racing and trying to think of the implications and what all this means. And so you're sitting there in the archives finding this stuff. What are you thinking as you're doing this?
I just kept thinking, I wish I had more. I wish I knew what was going on. And up until very close to the end, I really felt that there was something missing. And, you know, it was through a bit of sleuthing and finding a number of reports that actually talked about what other scientists, not themselves, but what other scientists were doing. I was able to put together these connections and realize that these, you know, because there's multiple experiments, actually, multiple studies that are happening during this period. And I needed to realize that they're actually all connected to one another and part of the same research program, even though it's, you know, different groups of scientists working on them.
So was there like the singular aha moment that you had? You found this sort of this thing that sort of maybe linked it all together and you said, this is it?
Well, in retrospect, it happened quite early. There was one document in which one of the main researchers sort of outlines exactly what's going to be done at each school. But for a while, that's all I had is this document. And I needed to actually get some sense of specifically what was going on at these schools. Actually, a real aha moment for me was looking at a BBC website for something else. I was reading the news, and they had an article on residential schools, and there was a photo of a young child having what looked like blood drawn from them.
Uh-huh.
And I looked at the photo, and I thought, I wonder if that's the experiments. And I eventually managed to track down the photo, and one of my undergraduate students who I was teaching was in Ottawa at the time and asked her if she could take some time to go to the archives and look through these photos, and she found them, and she found a box of photos from of the experiments taking place at two of the schools. And actually, for me, that was a really important moment to have that level of documentation of you know, what the experiments would have looked like in right. practice was really important.
Wow. You got an undergrad to do that. Wow, good for her.
She's a very talented undergrad.
Yeah, geez. Most of them would just tell you to shove it, wouldn't they?
I did pay her.
Okay. So. Oh, okay. All right. Like you said, your background is in food history, and now here you've stumbled on something that is a very sensitive topic. And I know I've never really done any First Nations history or Aboriginal history, but we did the podcast last year on the Nantuck brothers. And as we were going through and producing that, because we did it in different stages and we recorded the three different sections over the course of, I think it was 3 weeks. And one of the issues that we were having was, are we being sensitive enough to the topic? And are we engaging in cultural appropriation, which is a big issue? And so I was nervous with that show and putting that together until the final stages. And we sort of got, we ran past a bunch of people, and sort of people said, yeah, this is good. I think you're addressing it properly. So for you coming across this without that background in First Nations Aboriginal history, were you nervous at all in trying to write this article or address this issue? And did it ever occur to you maybe to whether or not run it by someone who's more familiar with that area of history, or even just to pass along this information and allow them to deal with it? Or were you always comfortable with the material?
One of the first things I did was begin an extensive reading in the secondary literature and mm-hmm. sort of familiarize myself with the topic, but I never felt comfortable. And I did ask a number of historians of Indigenous peoples to look at it and to read it over and tell me what they thought, and whether they thought I was on the right track, whether they thought I was being appropriately sensitive, whether my conclusions made sense, all of those sorts of things. And it, you know, even up to the day it was published, I was terrified as to what the response would be of the communities involved. And one of the things I really struggled with was I could stop the research now, you know, as I had it, I had the article ready, and approach the communities and ask what they wanted me to do with it. But this would take a really long time, and as a postdoc with minimal funding, it would delay it by years. Or I could try to publish it and hope that getting the story out, it would reach as many survivors as possible as they were getting up in years in terms of their age. And so it was a real struggle, and I talked to a lot of people to get advice about it. And I think the editors of Histoire Sociale, Social History agreed with me that the important thing was getting the story out, and they published it the turnaround between when I submitted it and peer reviews were finished and publication was very fast. And I think they agreed that getting the story out was important, and that would give the communities the opportunity to respond.
And the other question with respect to publication that I would have is, why social history as opposed to any other journal? I mean, it's one of those things, whenever you're looking for somewhere to publish, you look around and want to make sure that this article is right for this journal and so on and so forth. So what made you settle on social history?
Yeah, I thought about it a lot. One of the things about social history is I quite enjoy the journal. I subscribe to it and read a lot of the articles. And actually, in the end, there was a couple journals I was looking at, and social history has no word limit. And this is a very long article. It's upwards of 16,000 words. And I struggled. I thought, well, I could cut it down by another 7,000 words to fit it into other, you know, the rest of the Canadian journals. Then I would lose a lot of information that I think it needs to all go together. Like, the story needed to be told as a single story, not as a story broken up in multiple articles. And social history was very open to publishing an article this long. And, you know, I'm really thankful for that.
So let's talk about the media stuff a little bit, because you were all over the place for a few weeks there. Now, I'm wondering, though, when it first started, when did you get the sense that this was going to be a big story?
Well, the funny thing about it is that the article originally got picked up through Twitter. You know, I did what many academics on Twitter do. I posted a tweet saying, oh, my new article's out.
Yep.
And then a friend of mine, Tina Adcock, retweeted it saying, you know, followers interested in Northern issues should read this article. And it turns out one of her followers was a journalist with the Canadian Press. And so he emailed me within 5 minutes of that being retweeted, asking for an interview. And it was then that I was like, I became a little bit nervous that something was going to happen.
And nervous or excited? Because I can see why you're nervous, right? But at the same time, is not the hope of everyone who does this sort of research is to have something that resonates? Because I know that my stuff, I mean, I love broadcasting. I think it's really interesting. But the odds of me having something that gets this level of attention are so small. So is there not an excitement there, too, that this could have a serious impact?
It was. It was, you know, I was very excited. And, you know, there was a little bit of hope in me before the article came out that people will take this seriously and it'll have an effect. But I have to say, you know, my physical response was terror. And as soon as I was asked to do that interview, actually, I put the interview off. I think he emailed me on a Thursday. And I told him I couldn't do the interview till a Monday, mostly because I needed to mentally prepare for what was going to happen. Because one thing I've realized, I've been interviewed by a Canadian Press reporter before, and the article that I was interviewed in got published in nearly every newspaper in the country.
Right.
And so I knew what would happen with a Canadian Press article. It was going to be big because you know, most newspapers depend on the Canadian Press for stories, and so. You know, I kind of realized then that I needed to not sound stupid. And I did a lot of self-coaching to convince myself that I could do this and I would sound like I knew what I was talking about.
Well, but to that end then, is it in coaching yourself, were you practicing trying to come up or think about the best way to put this in short little sound bites? Because really that's what the media needs to a certain extent is short hits that describe it. And we just talked about how you put it in social history because you have 16,000 words that accurately explain everything. Yet now you're dealing with the media who wants things in quick hits. So is that part of your process?
Well, part of it was thinking of what are the most important things to say? What is the message I want people to get out of this? You know, and the message I wanted people to get out of it was that these experiments were awful, but they were not the worst thing that happened in residential schools. And Canadians need to understand that, that Canadians haven't come to terms with the residential school system. That was sort of the main soundbite I wanted to get across. And it didn't always succeed. And I think, you know, it was only after a lot of interviews where I was able to try to get that through. I also wanted to, you know, have the ability to say things clearly without academic jargon. That was something. So you do have to work in your mind to think about, well, how will I respond to this question, but not sound like an academic, but sound understandable and clear. And part of it was actually a list of things I didn't want to talk about. You know, I don't want to talk about the legal implications of this because I don't know. I don't want to speak for Indigenous people because I don't have, you know, that's not my place. And I don't want them to ask my opinion about a whole range of things, which ended up happening in every single interview.
They asked those questions anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, but so in advance, you didn't say we're not going to talk about this. You just,
no. In my mind though, I thought, well, what's my dodge?
Right.
You know, or just to know, like, well, I don't really want to talk about a key to doing media interviews. Actually, if they ask you a question that you don't want to answer, you kind of answer a similar but more important question.
Oh, okay. And then they'll just move on to the next one on their list because they're not really listening.
Exactly. And so one of the problems actually I faced was there were a large number of factual errors in the first article that came out.
In the CP article?
The CP article. And I emailed them right away for corrections. But one thing I learned about the wire service is everyone publishes the first version they get, not the corrected version.
Right.
And it made me very concerned about how people were talking about this. You know, people kept talking about it as starvation experiments, which they were not. They kept talking about how food was being withheld from children. And one of the messages I was trying to get across was they did not need to withhold food from children because the children were already malnourished. You know, systematically across the country in residential schools, children were malnourished. That, for me, was the bigger crime than the experiment themselves. Mm-hmm. And so it was getting that information across and making sure that the journalists understood, weren't repeating the errors from the original article, which they continued to do.
And you sort of touched on it. I mean, how frustrating is that for you in knowing that this is an important story on its own? And you don't want to say that they're not doing it on purpose, but maybe they're just looking to sensationalize in a way or put it in a way that I don't know, people will have to go read it or in a way that makes people sort of take back or put it in the most shocking way possible. I mean, how frustrating is that for you, knowing how you wrote it and knowing what the point of the article was?
It's enormously frustrating. And, you know, as someone who went through sentence by sentence, footnote by footnote many times to make sure that everything I was saying was as accurate as possible, and it made it difficult to hear a radio story or see a story on the news that misrepresented my research. And it, you know, it continued. The articles that get published still, there's almost always one or two factual errors per article. It's frustrating to me knowing that, you know, I've reread the article a number of times preparing for talks, and, you know, I think it's pretty clear in the article, but people don't read the article anymore. They read the articles about the article.
Right. So I guess sort of to that end, did you prefer, because you did print, radio, TV, you sort of ran the gamut, and then now you're here with me, which is clearly the biggest accomplishment, for sure. Totally. But you ran the gamut of the different medium, the different media. Was there one that you preferred because it gave you a better opportunity to express yourself?
I definitely preferred radio.
Mm-hmm.
And I preferred radio that was pre-recorded, but they did not edit it. So something like As It Happens. One of my first radio interviews was with As It Happens, which was, you know, for me, a huge honor. It's one of my, you know, something I listen to every single night. And I was interviewed by Rick McInnes Ray, one of my favorite journalists. So that alone was surreal, but it was good that I was able to tell the story in the words I wanted to use without somebody putting words in my mouth. And so when the interview played, it was painful to listen to myself, but at least, you know, all the mistakes were mine, and I was able to try to highlight what I thought was the most important thing about the article. One thing I didn't like was TV.
Okay.
Constantly misquoted, or they would take a single. One thing I found was I did a few TV interviews, and every time they chose the most ignorant thing that I said, and that was the only thing that would get put on TV.
Okay.
And, you know, it was frustrating. And actually, one thing about the media stuff is it looked like I was everywhere, but I turned down, I would say, 90% of all media requests.
Oh, really?
Easily. And, you know, my email, I would get 10, 15 emails a day asking to do interviews. And I did, you know, in the first few days I did quite a few, but, you know, after a while I would do, you know, one or two a day maybe. And I tried to choose, you know, one of the things I decided was any indigenous media organization I would always do an interview with.
Uh-huh.
Any media organization in a community that was where the experiments took place, I would always do an interview with.
Yeah.
But I would not do TV unless I really felt I had to. And I would not do live radio because it's terrifying.
That's not that scary.
I did a bunch, and
yeah,
it's just more scary because I'm, when it was live, I found I was stumbling more and I'd blank more often. And, you know, as a nervous person, it was
nerve-wracking. Well, I remember one time, I've watched a bunch of the stories too, and I agree that there was a couple of times where there was, you know, those sort of the national type stories where they do 2 minutes and there's the 3 second clip of the expert talking, that those could be difficult. But I saw, I think you were on, I don't know if you're on this, one of the news channels, one of the 24-hour news channels, and they gave you 6 or 7 minutes on that. I mean, is that not somewhat rewarding? Because it gives you that's a lot of time on TV, even though they have 24 hours and there's not that much to talk about in the news cycle. But to get 6-7 minutes on TV, that's pretty big. And in that setting, they can't misquote you because they're just asking you questions the whole time. So to me, that would be the best form to get the message out, because it has greater reach than radio. And you have control over what's being said, which you have on radio, but you don't have it in print. So it strikes me that would be an effective way or a rewarding outlet. But
I did interviews with CBC News World and CTV Newsnet, and yeah, those live interviews were good. One thing is, people would ask me if I would do an interview, and I would say sure, and they'd say, okay, when can you come to the studio? And you know, as a as a person who was entering the end of my postdoc and being asked to do a million interviews, you know, the idea of doing an interview at the studio takes a long time to get there, to set up, and to do it, and then you're on TV for a minute or two. So I thought that was not a very good use of my time, you know, and I would rather do more interviews than something like that. And I didn't want to do an in-person interview because it's just very awkward. So I would say I'll do it, but I'll do it over the phone. Mm-hmm. And they almost always said no, they would rather not.
Oh, really?
So all the TV interviews, except for one with the Aboriginal People's Television Network, were done via Skype or the phone, if they agreed to do it. And part of that was, I've had experience of media people coming to my house and filming me here, and it takes a really long time, and it's really awkward.
Right.
And then the end result is still just as bad as anything else. And so I did pick and choose what I thought would be, you know, the best venue for talking about these issues.
In doing that, though, did you ever fear that by turning stuff down, that maybe the story wouldn't be as well served as you had hoped?
Well, I tried to make sure that major media outlets, that I would always have a quote for them, because I wanted the story to get out, you know. The Toronto Star, like I said, published the story above the fold on the front page for 3 days. And I answered any question they had by email and sent them quotes and stuff like that. And I think that did help keep the story going. Same with, you know, the Canadian Press asked me, I would always do that. But one of the things is, I was, you know, I wanted the story to keep going, but I didn't want to be the story.
Right.
So one of the things I did whenever I would turn down an interview, I said, you should interview someone from the community or a survivor instead. That's a far more important voice that needs to be heard, you know. And this is one of the, that was also one of my concerns early on. I didn't want to be the story myself. And so I tried mostly to pass that off. And I think the most powerful stories to come out of the media coverage was interviews with survivors. There was an interview with a survivor on As It Happens the second day after the story broke that, you know, brought me to tears. Was such a powerful interview. The same was true of a couple of the Toronto Star stories, where they interviewed a number of residential school survivors, and those were the stories I wanted people to read. I didn't want them to read me.
Something that I noticed, and I think I wrote about this in the lead up, something that accompanied one of the podcasts in the summer, is that I thought you did a really good job of that, of letting the story be the story and not you be the story. And I could see if, like, I was in the same situation. Like you say, your postdoc's coming to an end. You're entering the job market. It would be really tempting to try and throw yourself in there at some point and say, look how good I am, right? I mean, I think could be a very natural human reaction. You need to advertise yourself for this point that you are in your career, and you resisted that. And which I thought was really quite remarkable, because in this similar situation, I don't know how I would have reacted, and trying to use that exposure more in terms of furthering my career.
Well, but you'd be surprised, because you love the research you do, and you care about it, and you want it to reach the biggest audience, and making myself the story would do the opposite. And so it wasn't that hard, you know. And one of the things I've realized, you know, my strategy probably wasn't great. You know, my strategy of giving a million talks, it doesn't make my CV look any better. I think it looks kind of weird on my CV, but the talks have been, you know, unbelievable. I've met so many people. I've met survivors of the nutrition experiments. I've met children of the survivors of these experiments. And regardless of what happens with my academic career, you know, I'll never forget those people in particular. And you know, I'm really lucky. it's sometimes I have to remind myself, you know, when I'm feeling bad about my current status as a semi-employed adjunct, that I couldn't have asked for more out of my career than what's happened in the past 6 months. And so, you know, that's a pretty amazing thing.
And with respect to those talks, I mean, and I know a lot of people use conferences and talks differently, but for me, I've always used them as a way. The talk itself is what it is, but for me, the best part is the question and answer. And that's where you get feedback, and that's where you get new ideas and ways to grow the topic. And especially for something like this, in addition, you get the experience of meeting people who were involved, or like you say, children of people who of the residential school students. I mean, that on its own is a pretty remarkable experience, like you say, and will make you a better academic moving forward.
One of the things I've given a couple talks at, one at the Millbrook Mi'kmaq First Nation in Nova Scotia, and another one at the Sechot First Nation in Port Alberni on Vancouver Island. And those were two of the most powerful days of my life. You know, survivors, the question and answer period was heartbreaking. You know, it's difficult to describe. People stood up and told their story to me. And as an academic, to have people who you've written about their lives in this way, to have them stand up and want to tell you their story, you know, I'll never forget that, and I'll always take it with me.
Now, as you've been doing these talks, and like I said, it's ianmosby.ca. If you look at his CV, you can see them all. It's quite an impressive list. I don't know if you think it makes your CV look weird. I don't know. I think it looks impressive. I think it's an impressive list of stuff. But as you've been going around doing these things, have you gotten the sense from people, not just survivors and family of survivors, but from other people involved in history or whatever, just academia in general, how has the reaction been to you in terms of acknowledging how significant this is? And do you get the sense that this is maybe the most important article that's been written in the last 10 years and the most important discovery that a historian has made in a long time?
Well, I don't know if I agree that it's the most important, but
okay, it's the most newsworthy.
Most newsworthy. Okay. Could be true. Well, there's a huge, supportive, amazing community of scholars on Twitter. You know, whenever I feel bad about academia, I think about just how amazing this group of really supportive people are, who just, you know, and I've heard so many nice things said about my work, you know, number of historians on Twitter, which is amazing. But one of the things I've noticed about the talks is far fewer historians come to the talks than people from other disciplines, nutrition, philosophy, biomedical ethics, medicine, law. Those are actually the communities that come to the talk. And I think that it's had a much greater impact on those disciplines than in history. One of the most common responses I get from historians is, well, of course that happened. But, you know, if anyone who's read about the residential schools, I think that's a reasonable response to a certain extent. But I just gave a talk last week at the U of T Law School, and hearing a number of young both law students and young physicians talk about the impact this research had on their perceptions, that's been more eye-opening, and it's definitely that's been interesting to me. And so maybe that's one of the reasons why the article had such staying power, is because it maybe gave a lesson to people who hadn't thought about history, the history of medical ethics or the history of Indigenous people or the history of nutrition. And it's now, you know, the thing they know about those issues. So the response has been pretty amazing from, you know, my talks. Tons of people have come. The question and answer periods have been fantastic. I've learned so much. And I've met people who want to work with me, and it's been fantastic in that sense. And one of the things I'm trying to put together is an article or something on working with dietitians and physicians on helping survivors understand the long-term effects of the experiments at malnutrition. And so the fact that I met so many really fascinating dietitians, physicians, et cetera, who want to help me with that is pretty amazing.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. But at the same time, did you get any backlash?
The backlash has been mostly in the comment sections of, of newspapers.
You shouldn't read those.
Which are, I should follow that rule. Do not ever read the comments.
If you want to feel bad about, not just if you want to feel bad about the world.
Yeah. Well, and it is a good reminder of how racist, you know, how insidious racism still is in Canada. Uh-huh. You read any comments on any story about Indigenous peoples. And the backlash in terms of the government has been to simply ignore right. ignore it completely, which isn't really a backlash, but it in itself has been moderately disturbing.
But so no one's attacked you?
No, thank goodness.
Right, because I read something. It might have been in a comment. I don't know, but someone wrote an article and about this. It was an article about your article. Just peel back the layers on that. But one of the things they said in the article was that you didn't editorialize in the social history piece. And there was a comment from someone below who probably didn't read the whole thing and took one line and said, this is editorializing and this guy doesn't know what he's doing or something. And so I was wondering if that sort of stuff would come up at all, as opposed to the comments. And I don't mean to bring that up to... That,
no, I remember that. That was one of the first articles that got published. I do remember that.
Yeah, so that sort of stuff. You didn't get a lot of that, and you didn't get angry emails from people saying you're an idiot and all that?
No, never in person, and the emails have been very supportive. Yeah, no, I expected it, but it didn't actually happen. And, you know, at all the talks, I've been expecting someone to stand up and denounce me, but that still hasn't happened.
That still actually, has it. You say it like you expect it to.
It probably will. I don't know. I'm waiting for it. What I have had, though, actually, is survivors and the children of survivors email me with their stories. It's been the most amazing and heartbreaking part of it is, you know, someone will email me basically an essay about their life, mm-hmm. And the impact that this knowledge about the researchers had on them. I had a woman send me an entire notebook, and she wrote basically her memoir of abuse as a child, and she mailed it to me.
Wow.
And that was one of those moments where I thought, I don't know what to do. And I wish she would have mailed it to someone more competent than me. But that's been, you know, the response from survivors has been different than I expected. And that's been something that's been pretty amazing, is to have people tell me that had a positive effect on their life and it's helping them to heal. You know, I could never have expected anything better than that.
No. And how can you? I mean, that's 99.9% of what we do. Well, I shouldn't say this about anybody. 99.9%, actually 100% of what I do, would not elicit a response like that. And that is pretty powerful. And pretty cool.
And it's one of those things that's, you know, I don't even know I don't know what to do with that. My experience, you know, one of the things I've definitely done is when I do talk to survivors and when I address communities, you know, I don't go in there as a researcher who's recording things and using stories. I just go there as a person who I'll listen. And mm-hmm. if people want me to do something, if they ask me to help or to tell their stories, then I'll do it. But otherwise I'm just trying to get this information out there and help people learn about it. And so that has been, you know, as a historian, it seems contrary to what we want to do, but it's been actually one of the most rewarding things is just to be there and to listen.
And it's a really cool opportunity because we don't have that a lot. To just sort of be part of this experience without looking that analytic part of us, bringing that into it, is just sort of to be there.
Like I said, I offer my services and people have taken it up. Some people have asked me to help them locate their medical records so that they can understand exactly what happened to them or whether additional experiments occurred. And those are things that I'm more than happy to help. You know, my skills as a historian are really useful. And so that's also been a pretty rewarding thing, is to try to answer questions people have.
There are still things being written about this. You sent me two things today. The NDP part, the NDPs in BC want there to be an official investigation into this sort of stuff. And there's a Globe article about how the experiments and the trickle-down effect that this is having now, and it still affects kids today. So I'm just wondering, as we continue to deal with this issue and continue to pull back the layers on this story, what do you think the lasting effects of this research will be?
Yeah,
that might be an unfair question. I don't know.
Well, no, I ask myself that all the time, and I ask the communities when I visit or when people email me, what's the best thing to do with this research? And I think one of the effects is it is perhaps forcing the government to acknowledge that a simple apology about residential schools was not sufficient, hopefully in the long term. One of the most amazing effects my research had was it came out at precisely the right time, totally by accident, in which the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was seeking an extension to its mandate and was seeking better access to government documents. And I think this gave really important ammunition to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which is so important, and to have it not fulfill its mandate and you know, not get the truth out would be a tragedy. And so that has been really important, and I think that might be, you know, one of the more lasting effects, is perhaps to give the opportunity for other stories to be told, or perhaps suggest to the government and to researchers that we need to take what survivors have been telling us for decades seriously. You know, one of the most common things that survivors have said is that, well, of course we were being experimented on. We've been saying this. You know, I said this 20 years ago. I said this when I was giving my statement for the residential school settlement agreement, but no one took it seriously. And so my article made it impossible not to take those claims seriously anymore. And so, you know, one of the things that I want to do is to investigate. You know, people told me other areas where they felt that medical experiments might have been taking place, and I'm going to keep trying to look into those.
So this is going to stay part of your research area. Like, you're not, this isn't a one-off for you?
No, this is officially my main research project. I could never have asked for more amazing response to this, but it also, one thing that the people I've talked to in Indigenous communities have said is that this research is important, and I need to continue it, you know, and see where it goes. And so, you know, I do feel obligated to keep digging and tell the complete story.
So the book, which is built off your dissertation, is called Food Will Win the War, The Politics, Culture, and Science of Food on Canada's Home Front. And that is coming out in May, right?
Yeah, hopefully. I think all I've left to do is the index. And yeah, I'm pretty excited to get it out there and hear what people have to say about it.
Yeah, that's through UBC Press. So we would encourage everybody to go look at that. And the article, Administering Colonial Science, Nutritional Research and Human Biomedical Experimentation in Aboriginal Communities in Residential Schools, 1942 to 1952, Social History, May 2013 issue. The paywall was down for a while. I'm pretty sure it's back up.
Yeah, unfortunately.
So you have to get it. If you have access to a university library, you can get it through a university library, or you can buy the issue of Social History.
Yeah, and I've heard that it is available via the Google.
Oh, if you just Google it, it's up?
Some people have posted it, Indigenous organizations. So.
Oh, okay. So you can find all that. And if you just Google Ian Mosby, you can find a bunch of the press stuff, the press articles on this. And, by the way, if you Google and, you know, those images come up, some interesting images come up, Ian. I don't know if you ever Googled yourself.
The male model.
Yeah.
My alter ego. Yes.
You should totally put one of those pictures on some of your profiles just for fun.
I would like to. Sometimes I dream about changing my life for his. But,
All right. And you can find Ian on Twitter, Ian_Mosby, adjunct professor at the University of Guelph. Thanks for taking the time. Crazy year for you.
Yeah,
not only the article and your son, congratulations on that as well. And I know this has just been a crazy time for you, but I'm so excited that we're able to work this out and we're able to get you on the podcast.
No problem. I was really glad to talk to you. It was fun.
All right. So again, that's Ian Mosby. Check out all his work. And if you have any questions, comments for the podcast, historyslam@gmail.com. Twitter is @DrShawneeFever. And if you're out, you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.